Welcome to Luck is Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, the host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. In October, the Audubon Society released a report stating that, quote, two-thirds of America's birds are threatened with extinction from climate change, but keeping global temperatures down will help up to 76% of them, end of quote. This follows a previous month's report that North America has already lost one-third of its bird population. But not to despair. There are things that we can do to protect the birds that are still with us. Of course, one of the principal changes we need to make is to reduce carbon emissions drastically and immediately. But as our guest today, Bob Salinger, Conservation Director for the Audubon Society of Portland, reminds us, we can also make important changes on a local and individual level that will help those 76% of birds survive. Bob, welcome back to Luck is Focus.
Thanks for having me.
Well, last summer sometime, I ran into you in Oaks Bottom, and you said to me, enough of this climate change. That's all you talk about on your show. How about talking about birds? So today, I'd like to talk about birds, but I also want to bring in climate change.
Right.
I think they're all connected.
They're very connected.
So how
and
are they?
And I'm glad you're doing shows on climate change.
Right. And I think we're going to get into that a little bit later in the show, too. Let's just start by talking about this report that the Audubon Society came out with just around the time, actually, that we ran into each other.
Sure. Actually, two reports came out this fall, as you mentioned, one from Cornell that was published in Science and another from the National Audubon Society. And they both give really, really dire perspectives on what's happening to North American birds. The report from Cornell, Decline of North American Avifauna, talks about the fact that approximately a third of North American bird species are declining precipitously and threatened with extinction currently. And they did some amazing work looking at particularly NEXRAD radar data for migrating birds and combining that with a variety of studies. Put a number on the declines over the last 48 years. They determined that approximately bird populations have declined by approximately 2.9 billion birds since about 1970.
Now, that's numbers of birds as opposed to species of birds.
That's total numbers of birds. And it's based on a variety of different data sources. But it's the first time that anybody's really put a number on declines. And that number is astronomical. The idea that total populations have declined by close to 3 billion birds over the last 48 years is frankly terrifying.
Well, one of the things that I found most alarming when I was reading these reports was some of the species that are declining are really common birds. Now, I've known for several years that rufous hummingbirds have been declining, and actually I can witness that. We used to have a lot more in our yard than we have now. On the other hand, Anna's hummingbirds seem to be expanding, maybe like the spotted owl versus the barred owl, I'm not sure. But one of the birds that really struck me, because I'm from back east, was the wood thrush, which was one of my favorite birds when I was growing up, a very common bird in the woods or in New England.
Right.
So if a bird like the wood thrush, and I also understand even robins are being threatened to some degree.
Yeah, yeah. It's remarkable how many different species are threatened. What they found really was that virtually every family of birds, except for waterfowl, were declining. And so forest birds are declining, shorebirds are declining, grassland birds are declining. In remarkable numbers. In the case of grassland birds, 53% of the species are seeing very, very significant declines. And so it's really across the spectrum. And I think oftentimes when people think of imperiled bird species, they're thinking of species on that are listed under the Endangered Species Act, threatened endangered species like the spotted owl and the marble murrelet and the sage grouse. But in fact, what they're finding is that common species are declining as well, species that we take for granted. So species that we have in our neighborhoods, like the rufous hummingbirds, sapsuckers, varied thrushes, bush tits, dark-eyed juncos, you know, these are species that people, I think, oftentimes think are increasing in numbers, but in fact, they're declining relatively speaking.
Well, speaking of that kind of counterintuitive thing, it's strange. When I was reading this report, I was thinking, well, in the neighborhood that I live in Portland, it feels like birds have really increased. And I've lived there for 26 years, and I swear that like there's double, triple the bird population now in my yard and also down in Oaks Bottom than there was in the early 90s. So probably that's not true, but I want to figure out like how do we sort of correlate what appears to be with what. Because you talk about bush tits being declining. Well, there were a whole bunch of bush tits that were in my backyard 2 days ago.
Right. And obviously, you're going to have local variations, and they're going to increase in some places and decrease in others, depending on what we're doing in terms of habitat and other factors. But overall, when we're looking at North America, what we're seeing is a lot of species are in very, very serious decline these days. And if these trends continue, we're going to have much less biodiversity in the next century than we have currently. And so, you know, there's a lot of things we can think about doing. But the other study that you mentioned that I want to talk about a little bit as well is National Audubon Study. What the Cornell study tells us is what's happening right now. And that's scary enough. But when you look at the National Audubon Study, which is called Survival by Degree, and looks at the impacts of climate change over time, and it put in a tremendous amount of data, things like Christmas bird counts, breeding bird surveys, a variety of other studies that have been done on a long-term basis, they found that coupling that with likely changes in habitat over time and other risk factors, that a tremendous number of species are going to be threatened with extinction from climate change over the next century as well. What they found was that about two-thirds, 64% of the species that they looked at would be threatened with extinction if there was an increase of 3 degrees Celsius.
Actually, and that's a report that had a number of my friends completely freaking out, and some of them didn't hear it quite right and thought they were going to be gone like next year. But and so this, that's one of the problems, actually, in getting people to act. If you think it's going to be next year, you might do something, but if it's going to be at the end of the 21st century, then, oh, well, we've got 81 years to worry about it.
Well, I think when you put these two reports together, what you see is that bird populations are already crashing right now. And that's been going on for a long time. They've been going downhill. The Cornell study shows long-term declines over the last 40, 50 years. And the Audubon study projects forward and layers climate change onto those declines and predicts even more dire outcomes, two-thirds of species potentially going extinct. So right now, we already have a third of North American species on the way toward extinction. And if we don't do anything about climate change, it's going to go up substantially. So when you put these two reports together, they're fairly devastating. And they're consistent with what we've seen in the past. These are more comprehensive than prior reports. But this, the trends have been apparent for a long time.
Now, again, I still feel like this is really counterintuitive thing going on, because it seems that well, one of the concerns is, of course, we need to really deal with habitat, which we should get into about
sure.
One of the reasons why this bird loss is happening. But I wonder what kind of role increasing and improving urban wildlife habitat has had on maybe giving us a sense that, at least in Portland, there's more birds than there used to be.
Well, I think when you think about these problems at a macro level, it's overwhelming. You know, what can you do in the face of climate change? What can you do in the face of these continental scale changes? And the answer is the same one that has always been true of the environmental movement, which is work locally, make the changes that you can make and affect the world that you want to see where you can have that impact. And so, you know, I think what it's going to take is some very large-scale strategies, but also people working at their local level, at their backyards, their neighborhood, and their community level to make changes as well. Because when we think about birds, we're losing them first and foremost because of habitat loss and fragmentation, but we're also losing them because of a variety of risk factors like collisions with buildings that account for upwards of a billion bird deaths a year, predation by cats, poisons and pesticides, poaching. There's a whole array of different hazards that are out there. And so we can do a lot in our own communities to try and improve things in terms of protecting habitat in our backyards, our neighborhoods, and through our parks and natural area systems, and in terms of reducing hazards.
Well, how much does backyard habitat matter? I mean, something it's fun to do. It kind of makes you feel good. But does it really make a difference if we turn, I have like a little yard, I think I have a 37 square foot lot, and in my little tiny backyard, I've done a lot of stuff for habitat. But is that really going to make a difference in the larger picture?
You know, it's funny, I get that question all the time. And again, I think progress is made by millions and millions of small acts as well as big acts. So we obviously need to focus on reducing carbon emissions, protecting big landscapes, but we also need to focus at a much smaller scale and make the differences that each one of us can make. And it's funny, we don't really ask that question when we talk about banning straws or planting a tree. But we do ask that about backyards for some reason. We have a great backyard program, habitat certification program that we administer with the Columbia Land Trust. Portland Audubon and Columbia Land Trust share that program. We have nearly 6,000 yards in the Portland metropolitan area enrolled in that system. And it makes a big difference because we have over 200 species of birds that migrate through Portland every year. They're impacted by a variety of factors, habitat loss and hazards and other things. And 40% of our landscape is covered in residential properties. And so when you think about that, if we want to make an ecologically healthy landscape for ourselves and for wildlife, we want to give these birds safe passage through our landscape. We can't ignore our own properties, our private properties, our community, our neighborhoods. We lose too much of the landscape. And so it does make a difference. The key is to take it to scale. And that's why we've developed this program that's very robust, over, again, nearly 6,000 yards enrolled in it. But it's a great thing to do. You can plant trees, plant shrubs, put out bird baths, provide food sources. And for all those birds that are traveling through the Portland metropolitan region, that's going to help sustain them as they make that journey.
Well, I understand probably your emphasis is on native plantings in your yard. But on the other hand, we have a beautyberry bush, which I'm sure is not native, and we've had it for many years and it's really matured. And so starting in late October has these gorgeous fuchsia berries, which are bird attractors. And this year the birds came early. And this is something we'll talk about in a little bit because the timing seems to be getting weirder. But usually starts with these robins and this one big fat robin that we think is kind of greedy. And he or she gets the lion's share of the berries in the middle, and then the smaller birds come. And a couple weeks ago, the last feasting was a whole flock of cedar waxwings, which just filled the tree for about a half hour. And it's just a really beautiful thing to watch. But we realize that this beautyberry is very important for probably, I don't know, maybe 100 birds that come and feed on it. And out in the bird network, the word gets out, there's this beautyberry on Flavelle Street in Selwood, and you should really check it out.
So you're already answering the question you were asking earlier, which is, you know, if you're getting hundreds and hundreds of birds coming through and using that food source, obviously it's important to them. They're finding it on an annual basis. And the more we do that to our landscape, the more permeable we make it, the more bird friendly we make it. And so it really does make a difference. And we hear that all the time. I'm always amazed. I live in inner northeast Portland. When I moved in, there were no birds there. As soon as I started naturescaping, we started seeing birds. So, you know, if you create that habitat, they will come. They're coming anyways. The question is whether they're finding what they need when they get here. And then there's also opportunities to really reduce hazards. Again, you know, bird collisions with windows kills upwards of a billion birds every year in the United States. Portland, a couple of years ago, adopted bird-friendly building guidelines for downtown that require new buildings to actually build in a way that reduces bird collisions and has set a standard for that.
And how do they do that?
Basically, by looking at the glazing on glass, and birds don't see glass as a solid object. They see it as open space and they will fly into it. So there's a variety of different ways to build buildings that reduce the likelihood that birds will collide with them. And that includes things like UV impregnated glass. Birds will see the UV in the glass avoid it, that you can put obstructions on the glass, you can have etched glass. There's a variety of different strategies to break up glass and demonstrate to birds that there's a solid object there rather than simply an open space.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Bob Salinger, Conservation Director for the Audubon Society of Portland, and we're talking about local initiatives to stave off bird extinctions. Speaking of birds crashing into windows, I've had two very bizarre experiences with that just in the last few months. In the late spring, we have a family of hummingbirds that I'm pretty sure has been nesting in one of the large bushes in our front yard for the last few years. And so there was this family of hummingbirds, I guess, and one day I came home and there was a tiny baby hummingbird that was lying dead on the porch with its wings outstretched and obviously crashed into this picture window in our living room. And we've been living there for 26 years, and it's the first time it ever happened. And it was very unnerving, and we haven't done anything yet to deal with it, though it's one of the things that's kind of in the back of our minds. A few months ago, I was interviewing a woman in Douglas County for a documentary I was doing on Jordan Cove, And we were in the middle of this interview, and this bird crashed into her picture window. She said that happens more frequently. And that bird lived, and we interrupted the interview, and she went out and took care of the bird and got it ready to, protected it till it was ready to fly back.
Right.
But when the options that I've seen for dealing with keeping birds away from your window were pretty ugly. And so I wonder if there's any aesthetic ways to do it or things that you can do that are little bit less weird than putting decals all over your picture window.
It's funny, the decals don't typically work that well because birds will fly through anything that's larger than they are. And so typically, to break up a window, you need obstructions about every 4 inches apart vertically and about 2 inches apart horizontally. And so when people put up a single hawk silhouette on their window, that oftentimes doesn't have any effect at all. Occasionally a bird may see that, go, oh, wow, there's a predator there, and back away. But more often, they're still going to crash into it. And so there's a variety of different things, from hanging streamers down in front of the windows to, again, UV glass, glass that's impregnated with UV. And so it shows up to the birds in a different way. There's window chalk. I've seen some really cool things that people have drawn on their windows just to sort of create a sense that there's something there. The key is to do it on the outside of the window. On the inside, it doesn't really work very well. And so if you go to our website, there's a whole lot of different strategies. And again, downtown buildings now that are heavily glassed have to use different strategies. Some of them also work for climate change. On bigger buildings, a lot of the things that we add to buildings, shades and things like that on the outside now, also serve to protect birds. So Portland's really leading and on the cutting edge on this. Another really exciting initiative that we're working with the city on right now, they allocated money to work on this in this current budget cycle, is light pollution. And light pollution is really bad for human health. It's really bad for wildlife, for migrating birds. It can really disorient them, cause them, again, to fly into things. In some cases, they actually get trapped in the light and circle until they wear out and crash into the ground exhausted. But it can really disrupt migration patterns. And so the city right now is working on a dark skies initiative that hopefully will roll out in the next year that will be, along with the bird-safe building practices, you know, hopefully set a new standard for light pollution in the city. It's one of those things we've gotten a great response on as well. People just hate light pollution. You know, whether you're concerned about your own health, whether you're concerned about wildlife, or whether you just want to see the night sky, light pollution is one of those things that we can really do something about. And so it's exciting to see the city moving forward on that as well.
Well, that's something actually that I've noticed is greatly increased in the almost 50 years that I've lived here. And when I first came to Portland, the skies were pretty dark at night. And if you also, more notably, if you just went up in the West Hills and you went up like along Skyline and you looked west, it was dark, absolutely dark. And I was struck by how much things changed. It was many years ago, but I wanted to watch the shooting stars, and I just moved back to Portland from Mount Hood, and I wasn't familiar with what had happened west of town in the several years that I've been living out in Mount Hood. And we go up to Skyline, and I look over to the west, and there's the lights of Beaverton.
Yep.
And it was really, I mean, it was very disturbing, actually, and you couldn't see any shooting stars at all. But I wonder why we need to even have lights, because that seems to be one of the easiest things to change.
It is, and it's funny, because I think Portland has sort of a small to mid-sized city mentality. It thinks being a big city means being lighter, but actually a lot of big cities now are going the opposite direction, and a great example is Chicago, where Mayor Daley, when he was mayor, developed a Lights Out initiative. And it's startling to see the difference before and after in downtown Chicago. You go back prior to Mayor Daley, and the downtown skyline was just lit up like a Christmas tree. And today, it's very, very dark. They have really done a tremendous job of getting people to turn off their night lighting, especially in big buildings. And there's a marked difference. And so it can be done. So much of our light is wasted. It's aimed in the wrong direction. It's aimed upward. It's scattered. It trespasses in places it doesn't need to go. It wastes energy, and in often cases, it doesn't make us safer either. When you have bad lighting, it creates shadows and uneven lighting in a way that it makes it very difficult for people to see. So oftentimes, the biggest argument we hear is you know, if you reduce lighting, it won't be safer. In fact, people often see much, much better in reduced lighting. So there's a tremendous amount that we can do in this area, both at a citywide and region-wide scale, and also just individuals taking a pledge. We have a pledge on our website. You can go to it and pull up our Take the Pledge lights out that people can do in their own yards to reduce lighting.
Well, we were talking about this a few weeks ago, about like porch lights can be a big problem. People have these porch lights that are kind of like searchlights. In fact, I have a neighbor behind me, he has them all over his house.
Yep.
We have a porch light that I think it's basically, well, no, I think it radiates out. But if you had a porch light that just went down, would that be more effective than having one of these globes that kind of emits light in all directions?
Absolutely. There are several things we can do. We can shield lighting so that it doesn't go upward. We can aim it where we want it to go and not beyond. We can reduce the intensity. So there are a variety of different factors with lighting that reduce impacts on birds, but also on human beings as well, because it is a human health issue as well. And it's really been great because we've seen a tremendous response from the public on this issue. It's something that people get intuitively, and it's a place where we can really, again, make a difference. And if you're a migrating bird coming through the city and there's good habitat in people's yards, we have a nice system of parks and natural areas, the lighting is reduced so they're not disoriented when they're migrating. There's less hazards in terms of glass. People are keeping their cats safe at home so they're not preying on birds. We're reducing pesticides. These things are going to make a difference over time. And this is kind of how we're going to bring it back. Then we also need to think bigger as well. And I think one of the really exciting things that just happened was that voters overwhelmingly passed the Metro Green Space bond measure. $475 million will now be allocated to adding to our system of parks, trails, and natural areas. It was supported in all three counties. We passed two previously.
Even Clackamas County this time?
Clackamas County, Washington County, and Multnomah County, you know, overwhelmingly. And so, you know, people really get it. And that's a shift as well. Audubon was involved in the first green space bond measure back in 1992 that did not pass. It came very, very close. It was at a time when people were asking, why do we need to protect nature in the city? This is a city. This isn't for nature. This is for people. And so even as recently as 1992, people were still coming to an understanding that, you know, we have a responsibility to protect our environment and urban ecosystems. A bond measure did pass in 1995, and then again in 2006, and now we've passed a third one. And each time, the amount of support has grown dramatically, and the results are really tangible. We have places like Chehalem Ridge and Cully Park and Nadaka Nature Park and the Gresham East Buttes and Clear Creek Canyon, you know, amazing places that are protected today because the voters in this region have recognized the importance of protecting nature.
Where are some of these places specifically so people can go visit them?
Well, they're all over the place. You know, I mean, in downtown Portland, we have places like Oaks Bottom. You can go out to the Gresham Buttes beautiful treed buttes out there. Chehalem Ridge in Washington County is just an amazing place to go. See bluebirds and a variety of different wildlife. So, you know, we have this incredible system of parks, trails, and natural areas, but we need to keep building it. It's not complete. There's still a lot of places at risk, and this new ballot measure that just passed will help continue that work.
So what are these places at risk for? I mean, unless they're protected, what would be happening?
Development. I think a lot of places that people still take for granted are not in public ownership and at risk of development. And so, you know, it's critical that we continue to fund these kinds of initiatives so that we can bring more and more land into the public system, and also so that we can achieve equity goals as well. Because although we have a great system of parks, trails, and natural areas, there's still many people in this region that don't have a park or natural area within walking distance of their home. That tends to play out based on income and race. And so as a matter of equity, it's also important that we continue to invest in building the system.
Well, there seemed to be some bit of a contradiction a few years ago where there's a big push, I mean, and this maybe goes back to 92 or beyond, before that, where there's a big push to infill in order to keep from sprawling. And so it was kind of like you had the choice, you either sprawl into the farmlands and woodlands outside of town, or you just build every on every inch in town. And one of the things that we've seen with that mentality is in every neighborhood, particularly on the east side, I think much more on the east side than the west side, where there used to be these little open space pockets or just little houses with backyards got torn down, a whole bunch of those, and now these large apartment buildings that are mixed use, and they sort of exhibit a lot of the goals of considered what's considered smart growth. On the other hand, they took out a lot of trees and a lot of nature. Right. So how do we balance that?
We need to do both, and we can do both. And I think oftentimes it's portrayed as a contradiction, especially by developers. If you don't want to have sprawl, then you have to let us destroy natural areas and cut down trees. And that's just not accurate. What we really need are livable cities. We need to prevent sprawl, so our urban growth boundaries are incredibly important in protecting farmland and big tracts of natural area out beyond the UGB. But we also need to make our cities healthy and livable as well, or people won't want to be there and we will sprawl. And so we need good planning, and we have very good planning in this region that allows us to protect the places that are most important from an ecological perspective. We need a good system of regulations to protect our stream corridors and make sure there are good buffers on those. We need good tree codes to make sure that when we build, and we do need to build intensively, but that we build in a way that protects and preserves tree canopy in neighborhoods. There are absolutely ways to do this with good planning, good regulations, and good outreach programs.
Well, I think about some of the changes that happened in development practices in the last 25 years, but that were still kind of heartbreaking. I think about Costco, the Southeast Costco, and it used to be over by McFarland's out just west of I-205. And it was just one of those, it was just paved over, this, I don't know how many hundreds of acres of just cement and asphalt and paving in this low, long-strung building. And then they moved to a new place that was just a little bit southeast of the old store. And there was a creek on their lot there. So they worked, built around the creek, which I guess was required by the 90s when they did this building. And so the creek was preserved, and there's a parking lot, and there's a big Costco that's at least as big as the old one. And so on the one hand, I was really happy to see that creek. On the other hand, it looked like a creek that was in prison because there's no, I mean, it's not really respecting the riparian area. So have things gotten better since then? Because that's one of the problems. And the same thing is even worse on the west side with a lot of the industrial parks that got built in that same time in the 90s and early aughts.
Things are improving. I think one of the things this region is increasingly known for is green infrastructure and its green infrastructure programs. So, for example, the city of Portland, when it adopted a central city plan a couple of years ago, now requires green roofs on top of every single building in downtown Portland. Every single building over a certain size now has to have a green roof. We have a tree code that is reasonably effective, but could be improved substantially. We are increasingly putting larger buffers on our creeks in Portland. A lot of the surrounding municipalities are not doing as good of a job. We have a tremendous opportunity coming up. The city right now is looking at the south reach of the Willamette River, which basically is the portion of the Willamette River south of OMSI in the city of Portland and the code that currently protects it. Right now, the Willamette River only has a 25-foot wide setback. And so you can basically build up to within 25 feet of the river. That's way too small. We know from a variety of research that 25 feet is completely insufficient to protect the water, to provide for fish and wildlife needs. And so the city right now is redoing the code for that portion of the river. They're proposing to expand the setback to 50 feet. We believe it should be 100.
At least.
At least 100, bare minimum of 100. And that's a place where you could do that. We also need mechanisms in that plan to ensure that where there is existing development, that over time, either through regulation or incentive, it moves back. We should do that for water quality. We should do that for fish and wildlife. We also should do that because we need more resilient landscapes. And it's crazy in an era of climate change to be building close to water bodies. We learned that lesson over and over the hard way. We need to be pulling back and creating much, much wider zones for our streams and rivers. The city of Portland has a great program out on Johnson Creek where they've been doing a willing seller effort in which they buy up properties in the creek's floodplain that have flooded repeatedly over the years and restore them to habitat. And we need a similar program along the Willamette River as well.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And we're talking today with Bob Salinger, who's the Conservation Director for the Audubon Society of Portland. We're talking about the impacts of development on birds and why birds are shrinking in numbers across the world, and particularly across North America, but also seeing how we can expand them here in Portland. When you talk about the south reach of the Willamette River, it's kind of interesting because there's a stretch of it, like just south of OMSI, where they started, it hadn't been fully developed. I mean, it was mainly Ross Island, was sand and gravel, was the only really big development south of OMSI. And so there's the Springwater Corridors there now, and there's some really nice places, nice views of the river. It's sort of industrialized. And then you get beyond Ross Island, and or Ross Island Sand and Gravel, and all of a sudden you're in the woods. And to me, that vision, which goes all the way down to Milwaukee almost, is what the river should be like on the east side. And on the west side, actually, when you get down around across from the Selwood Bridge, it becomes quite natural too. Okay. And it's such a contrast to the river that goes through downtown Portland, which when I first moved here, I was really surprised at this river that was like confined by these walls, which I didn't understand at the time that they were built, because the river flooded, and without those walls, the river would flood into the city. Right. But it seemed like there was a very alien relationship to the river that was, even for my standards of like having lived in New York and Boston, where the rivers are pretty polluted and they're pretty built up. But even the Charles River in Boston had wider setbacks going through downtown Boston than the Willamette had going through downtown Portland.
That's absolutely right. Portland has done a terrible job protecting its river. You know, we call ourselves the River City, but we are truly alienated from this river. Physically, it's very hard to get to. We have channelized it. We've steepened its banks. We've hardened its banks. We've taken down vegetation in its riparian areas. We've filled its floodplains. We've really treated our river very, very poorly. And of course, we've also polluted it. There's a 10-mile stretch in Portland Harbor that is a Superfund site that's was listed in 2000 and will probably take another 15 to 20 years to clean up. And so we have a long way to go on this river, but we are making progress. And so, you know, the kind of things we need to be thinking about and the public really needs to engage in are these river planning processes that increase protections, increase setbacks in riparian areas, protect floodplains. You know, it's amazing. At Swan Island, it was so shallow historically, you used to be able to walk across the river there. What we've done to this river impacts not only ourselves, but also, for example, every salmon that uses the Willamette River system, you know, which flows 185 miles northward, has to pass through downtown Portland. Many of the salmon that use the Columbia River system also come into the Willamette temporarily into those polluted waters before they go up the Columbia. So it's tremendously important that we protect and recover this stretch of river. In the South Reach in Portland, as you note, there's some pretty good habitat remaining. We need to protect and expand that. In the North Reach, the Industrial Harbor, we also need to clean up our pollution. We need bigger setbacks, and we need to restore those banks as well.
I was just thinking about, I was given a tour a number of years ago of Swan Island, the kind of the natural areas around Swan Island, and it was as it was being declared a Superfund site, and there was a river otter floating on a log that was going down the river, and it was just a very strange thing to see because this river otter was enjoying itself as otters always seem to enjoy themselves, and yet it was in this really polluted stretch. So it seemed to me to really cry out for the need to, just for the sake of the river otter, to do something to make this little trip that they're taking down the Willamette a lot healthier and a lot more pleasurable.
Yeah, I mean, a Superfund site is really a remarkable thing. You know, we have over 150 different responsible parties that polluted this river over the last 100 years through a variety of different means and activities. We have a huge number of different contaminants, PCBs and DDT and heavy metals. Nearly 11 miles of that river is contaminated. It was listed as a Superfund site in 2000. That's a designation that we give to our most complicated and polluted sites in the nation. It took 16 years to get to a record of decision on how the cleanup would occur. That didn't occur till the end of 2016. The EPA is now currently working with the responsible parties to come to agreements on how they will clean up their individual sites, and we expect that to wrap up in the next several months. And then hopefully we're going to get into very, very active cleanup, removal of contaminated areas. In some cases, it will be covered over. In other cases, it will be removed entirely from the river. In some cases, it will be allowed to recover naturally. But it's critically important that we actually get to that active cleanup process.
Now, I remember a couple of years ago that there was a lot of discord about the agreement, and it seemed like the EPA had basically kind of just dropped the ball and was letting a lot more toxins remain in the river than people like you thought was safe. Has that been resolved in a more favorable way?
It has been, and that really speaks to the power of grassroots activism. When the EPA came out with their original cleanup plan, it was incredibly weak. Basically, it relied on something called natural recovery, which essentially allows the river to slowly cover over the contamination, or the contamination gets flushed downstream.
To Astoria, which they were appreciated.
And so the EPA was going to really rely on this very heavily. And what we were told at that time was once they put out their draft plan, it very rarely changes. There was a huge grassroots mobilization that occurred. The EPA received more than 5,000 comments, and they came back with a much stronger plan. And so that really did make a difference. So far, it appears that the EPA is moving forward with this cleanup and holding polluters accountable. That was something we've been watching very closely because under this administration, we've seen a lot of the environmental framework that we depend on collapse and be undermined. But it does appear that for the most part, the EPA is continuing to push this forward. But they need to be watched very, very closely. And there are some issues that we do have with some of the decisions they've been making recently. But it's important the public remain engaged because the agreements that each one of these responsible parties signs ultimately is going to determine how this river gets cleaned up and how long that takes.
Well, while we're exploring the industrial part of Portland, let's talk about trees, because that's another area which is really important for bird survival. And it also is a place where maybe Portland is not quite as great as its reputation would have you think.
As you noted earlier, we've lost a lot of trees over the years as development has come in. And Portland does have a tree code. It's under Title 11. We helped develop that several years ago. That does not require that people protect trees, but it does require in many cases that if they do cut a tree down, they have to mitigate for it. They have to either put money into a fund to plant trees or plant replacement trees. And that's very important because if we don't have those kinds of regulations, we're going to slowly lose our canopy over time. It also provided resources to help work with developers to avoid tree cutting wherever possible. And so that duality of first of all, providing resources to encourage developers to avoid cutting trees and to protect them on development sites. And then secondly, to require them to mitigate when they do cut them is a fairly effective combination in trying to protect our canopy. Unfortunately, when the city council adopted its tree code, better part of a decade ago, they exempted commercial and industrial lands. Basically, there are no regulations protecting trees on commercial and industrial lands in Portland. The reason they did that at the time was that industry argued that the city's industrial land inventory was out of date and it would be unfair to them to update the tree code on their properties until we had a good sense of whether we had enough industrial land or not. The city should have never acquiesced to that, but they did. They promised at the time that once the industrial land inventory was resolved, they would come back and address this exemption. Unfortunately, that never happened. Once they were exempted, the city put its head in the sand and basically ignored this issue, despite the fact that many groups have gone to them repeatedly over the last decade and said, the industrial land inventory issues are resolved. It's time to hold industrial and commercial properties accountable for tree cutting. The results are real. The fact that we don't have these protections is absolutely resulting in tree cutting that is unmitigated. And one big example that we're seeing right now is at Wapato Jail. Jordan Schnitzer bought that property. That property has a buffer. It sits right on the edge of Smith and Bybee Lake's natural area. And that property has a tree buffer that is 40 feet wide and 2,400 feet long. It's comprised of hundreds, if not thousands, of trees. Mr. Schnitzer is proposing to cut down those trees as he redevelops that property. Not only will we lose a tremendous number of trees, it will also expose Smith and Bybee Lake to pollution, to noise, to light. It will have a really, really detrimental impact on the lakes. Unfortunately, there's absolutely nothing stopping Mr. Schnitzer from doing that because the city doesn't have a tree code that applies to his property. He met with advocates a while back and came into the room and heard us out, and we're trying to work with him to find better solutions for this property. But one of the things he said to us, and he was very candid about this, was that he didn't have to meet with us at all, that there was absolutely nothing in the city code that required him to do anything to protect trees or talk to anybody about cutting them down. And so, unfortunately, he was right on that, too. We have asked the city to revisit this. The Portland Planning and Sustainability Commission and the Portland Urban Forestry Commission have both recommended that the city council lift the exemption for trees on industrial and commercial lands. We thought the city was going to take that issue up this Thursday. Unfortunately, we got word from the mayor's office last week that they're delaying that indefinitely. It is long past time that the city addressed this issue, held commercial and industrial property owners accountable, and protected trees on those properties. And so right now we are lobbying and we're encouraging other people to lobby the mayor's office to move forward on the recommendations that were made by the Planning and Sustainability Commission and the Urban Forestry Commission and put those protections in place. They should have been in place a decade ago.
Now, you sent me a draft the other day of basically your statement about this. Do you have a more polished thing that we could go public and I can put it on the website?
Yeah, it's up on our website now. And so we basically give ways to contact the mayor's office prior to the hearing. We're encouraging people to come out for the hearing as well.
And the hearing's this Thursday at 3 o'clock?
Yeah, and the hearing is no longer specifically about this exemption. There's two issues that the city is looking at regarding trees right now. The other one is that the city has protections for larger trees that were adopted a couple of years ago on non-commercial and industrial properties that had a sunset clause in them. Those protections are good. They're important. And so the city council this Thursday is going to meet and discuss lifting that sunset clause so that those protections stay in place. At the same time, they were also supposed to talk about these exemptions for commercial and industrial lands. Unfortunately, that's the part of the hearing that's been suspended now. We're encouraging people to come out and talk about both issues. Encourage city council to lift the sunset clause on protections for big trees. Those protections should stay in place. And immediately take up the issue of the exemptions for commercial and industrial lands.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. We're talking today with Bob Salinger, Conservation Director for the Audubon Society of Portland, about what we can do here locally to help birds not go extinct as they are threatened with the pressures of climate change and all kinds of development. Well, tying into this whole issue about the tree ordinance, I got an email from some people I had on the show a few months ago who are the Friends of the Moreland Woods, which is a tiny little woods over on Southeast 14th between Bybee. Well, actually, it's like between Glenwood and Duke, and it's right next to just north of Portland Memorial Mortuary. And there's been this nice little, I won't say it's really a woods, but a bunch of, a stand of old tall trees. And it's a great place to go for walks. And people walk their dogs there and kids play there. And it's actually the only pocket of green in that part of the neighborhood in Westmoreland. I mean, the rest of Selwood has this amazing green network, but that section is not really, doesn't have direct access to Oaks Bottom. So this was kind of the little hub of nature. So I got an email from them talking about the meeting, the city council meeting on Thursday, and urging people to come to that to advocate for this tree protection, because they're, I guess they're seeing it as a way for them to deal with the new owners of Portland Memorial who want to cut down all those trees and put up a parking lot. Seriously. So would what you're arguing for, would that include protections for Moreland Woods?
If it's commercial property, it would. It won't stop them from cutting the trees, but it will require that they mitigate for them. And that can be very, very expensive. And when a developer is faced with the costs of mitigating for cutting down those trees, a lot of times they'll start to look for other solutions. We find that all the time. If there are no protections on the property, the developers will tell us they need to develop every square inch or it doesn't pencil out. The minute there are regulations that start to cost them money for impacting natural resources, suddenly they start to become a lot more creative and they start to find ways to work around those natural resources. And that's why it's so important. You know, and I really appreciate the work that the neighbors are doing on that site. That is a neighborhood, though, you know, that does have Oaks Bottom and a variety of other natural resources. We fully support their efforts. It's important what they're doing. But it's also important to understand that many, many industrial sites are neighborhoods that have very little tree canopy at all. And oftentimes, again, lower income, more diverse neighborhoods, our industrial lands are interspersed with our neighborhoods. They're also adjacent oftentimes to very, very important natural resource areas. I mentioned Smith and Bybee earlier, but also the Willamette and Columbia Rivers too. Johnson Creek is surrounded by industrial lands. And so protecting trees on industrial lands is really, really important because those trees provide buffers for those natural areas. And they also provide buffers and clean air and reduce urban heat island effects in some of our most vulnerable neighborhoods. So it's really a matter of ecology, but also, again, a matter of equity that we protect these trees on these lands. It's also part of just building a resilient, healthy community. The city has an overall tree canopy target of 33%. We are not making progress toward that at this point. And the way we're going to make progress toward that is to protect trees on all the different types of landscapes we have, to hold everybody accountable. When we think of climate change, one of the most effective things we can do to keep our communities resilient is to plant trees. They sequester carbon. But they also reduce urban heat island effects, and we're going to see much more dramatic urban heat island effects in the coming years. Portland already has one of the biggest urban heat island effects in the country. People don't realize that, but if you measure the difference between the temperature in Portland and the temperature in the surrounding more rural landscape, Portland has one of the biggest discrepancies of a major city in the United States. And that's going to get more and more exacerbated over time.
I've actually noticed that when I'd be bicycling from KBOO back home in Selwood, and I would notice how when I finally hit Milwaukee, where I was going alongside Elk's Bottom, the temperature felt like it dropped 10 degrees.
It's remarkable. You know, I'm very fortunate I get to work up in Forest Park in the woods. I live in King neighborhood, which is a very tree deficient neighborhood. And it is startling when I come home from work, the temperature variation coming out of Forest Park, coming across the river and entering into the flatlands of Northeast Portland. It can be a huge, huge difference. And that's something that's going to affect our frontline communities, our most vulnerable populations in a major way in the coming decades. So we really need to prioritize protecting existing trees and planting trees in those neighborhoods. And part of the way we're going to get at that is on commercial and industrial lands.
Now, let's get back to birds. So how, if we protect the tree canopy and expand the tree canopy in Portland, how is that going to impact the health and diversity of our bird population?
It affects them because it makes a more permeable landscape. Again, more than 200 species pass through Portland. You know, this is a major migratory corridor. They follow rivers. And so you have the Columbia and the Willamette. You know, this Portland was historically this incredibly fertile floodplain. It was a biodiversity hotspot. And the birds are still going to come through Portland, whether we've developed it or not. The question is, will they have what they need as they pass through? You know, as I said earlier, it begins with creating a really great system of parks and natural areas, protecting the most important sites. It also involves protecting the corridors through regulation and making sure we have good setbacks. But it also means creating landscape permeability, taking the developed landscape and making it as permeable and safe for birds as possible.
Permeable meaning what?
Meaning giving them habitat opportunities, trees, restored yards, eco-roofs, and then reducing hazards, as we mentioned earlier, light pollution, windows, cat predation, pesticides. You know, how do we make it as safe as possible as these animals traverse our landscape? And, you know, we started by talking about these incredibly profound declines. Part of the way we're going to reverse that is by creating safe, healthy landscapes for people and wildlife.
Well, one last thing, because I've been having this conversation with a lot of bird watchers in Oaks Bottom, is we're noticing differences already in migratory patterns. One of the biggest differences this year has been that the waterfowl migration seems to start much later, and it hasn't come with the kind of abundance we are expecting. The birds are kind of dwindling in and sort of staggering, as opposed to there being five or six, or one time I was down there, I counted 15 different species of ducks.
Right.
And now if I see three or four different species, I'll be really happy. So do you have any idea what's going on? And beyond the ducks, is that also a problem with the songbird population and other birds?
Yeah, I'm not sure what's going on there at Oaks Bottom this season. You're going to get seasonal fluctuations that will vary from year to year. A lot of times it depends on what the weather is up north. What we are seeing, though, is more and more variation year to year in terms of what's happening, and that is a reflection of climate change. As we see climate changing, habitats changing as well, more variable weather patterns, we're seeing much less predictability in terms of when birds show up and where they show up and in what numbers. And so we're really in uncharted waters already in terms of what these continental scale changes are doing to our bird populations.
Well, one of the things I wondered about is that I've heard a lot about the problem with the lack of correlation between the needs for the birds and the what they prey on, or what the, whether it's the vegetation that they eat or the other wildlife that they prey on. And I'm just wondering if that's one of the things that's going on with the ducks, if maybe they've found out that what they need in Oaks Bottom isn't going to be there until December as opposed to being there in late October.
It's possible. You know, it's very possible that somewhere else in their migratory route, you know, weather patterns were less extreme this year, and so they haven't come south as quickly, or something's just going on at Oaks Bottom. So it's hard to say on a site-specific basis what could be happening there. You know, waterfowl are one bright spot in this otherwise very, very dire situation that we're getting from these reports that we started out talking about. Waterfowl have been increasing overall, and they're the exception to the rule. And the reason that scientists think that waterfowl have been increasing is because we have made tremendous, tremendous investments in this country in protecting and restoring waterfowl habitat. The one place that we really, really have invested very strategically and in very large amounts of money is in waterfowl habitat protection and restoration.
Which is like wetlands in particular.
Wetlands, yeah. And as a result, we have seen waterfowl species overall doing better. But they are the exception to the rule, and we need that kind of investment and that kind of strategic planning for other families of birds as well.
Well, Bob, it's great to talk with you, and it's been nice to talk about birds for a change. So let's do this again soon.
Hey, thank you for having me.
And actually, probably next time we talk, we should probably be talking about zenith and some of the other horrors that we're facing that are also threats to the birds. So,
well, and you know, ultimately, if we're going to save birds and we're going to save ourselves, that is the biggest threat. facing us.
Well, thanks a lot. We've been talking with Bob Salinger, Conservation Director for Audubon Society of Portland, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our public affairs programming, you can go to KBOO FM or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. Next week, we'll talk with Dan Sears with Columbia Riverkeeper about recent developments in the struggle to stop the world's largest methanol refinery from being built in Kalama, Washington. It's sort of good news. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Taj Mahal. Thanks for listening.
Thing. I learned to love you, baby, before I call, honey, before I call your name. Baby, before I call, honey, before I call your name. I wouldn't trade your love for money. Honey, you're my warm heart, baby, you're my warm heart's flame. Have mercy, baby, on my heart, look, mama, on my heart, look, so. Baby, on my heart, look, honey, on my heart, look, so. Got a rainbow around my shoulder, shine like silver, baby, look like Klondike gold. Sure don't mean a natural thing.